welcome our listeners to another episode of the Energy Central Power Perspectives podcast. Located in New York City, I'm your host, Jason Price of West Moreau Partners and Community Ambassador for Energy Central. Joining me is my colleague, Matt Chester, Community Manager for Energy Central and located in Orlando, Florida. Matt, how are you doing today?
Hi, Jason. Feels good to be back in the proverbial podcast studio with you once again. As this year has gotten fully underway, it definitely seems like we're starting to see some important utility sector stories take hold. And I've connected with today's guest on EnergyCentral.com numerous times, and I know how critical this topic is, so I'm just excited to dive into it with them. So I'll say, let's just get right into it, Jason.
Excellent. It's great to hear. For our listeners, I'd like to share that since 1995, Energy Central has been a trusted news and information source for professionals working in the power industry. Today, Energy Central is more than just a news source. Energy Central is a network of community groups focused on specific topics in the industry. Our managed communities are a place where professionals like you can come together to share, learn, and connect in a collaborative environment. We invite you to become a member, if you haven't already, and join 200,000 other professionals working in the power industry. To join, just visit www.energycentral.com, and membership is free. Our next guest is living the expression, flying the plane while building it. Dick Brooks is front and center, helping to shape the capacity markets in New England, and is advising and influencing key decision makers who are stepping into uncharted territory on the energy supply. The outcome of his work could impact the future of the wholesale capacity markets nationwide as we know it. He has recently been busy with major discussions on this topic with legislators, regulators, and influential government officials, which we'll discuss shortly. It's a pleasure to have you on today's episode of Power Perspectives.
Well, thanks very much, gentlemen. I'm happy to be here.
Our listeners will quickly realize that our guest has vast and deep knowledge in the New England capacity market. Dick Brooks spent nearly two decades with the ISO in New England, building the ISO's business intelligence and data analytics platform. He has extensive experience building and managing technical teams focusing in areas of risk management, cybersecurity, and marketing monitoring operations in the energy field. He has won many awards, industry recognitions, and holds patents on various technical applications. Dick Brooks is currently CEO of Reliable Energy Analytics, a consulting company focused on the data and security analytics of the energy industry. He is a prolific contributor to Energy Central with 56 articles, over 300 comments, and has accumulated over 112,000 views of his work, which all can be found on Energy Central platform. Now, let's get to the meat of the matter. Massachusetts is one of a handful of progressive states that recognize the climate imperative and have supported a renewable energy future. The state leads in renewable generation, investment, and innovation. Dick, set the stage for our listeners how an influx of new generation, in this case, low-cost renewables, affects the capacity market, and specifically, the New England ISO.
Thanks, Jason. Yeah, ISO New England was really the first ISO to implement a forward capacity market using a descending clock auction. And we were sort of the pioneers in that sense, in that, you know, we were trying to procure capacity 3 years into the future and trying to predict what the energy profile is going to look like that far out it can be a little bit challenging. We really kind of have to do that in order to allow new generators enough time to construct and become, you know, operational. So you're kind of in this situation where you got to try and predict what the future looks like. But the current times around us are changing so rapidly that it makes that a very difficult challenge. And so, you know, the FCM work, it was in 2010 when I was a capacity market clearing engine software architect. It was kind of an interesting story because no one had done an FCM clearing engine before. ISO had hired out a consultant to do the work. And about 6 months before the project was to be delivered, we were informed that, you know, that the vendor wouldn't be able to complete the clearing engine. So there were a few of us in ISO New England who were brought into a room and told that we had 6 months to write this, design it and write this clearing engine. So it was kind of an on-the-spot thing. We all had to jump in and figure out. And again, it was first one in the nation, so it was quite a challenge. But we did it. And since, you know, since that time, it was working well for a few years. But then we started to see some real issues of overbuying of capacity by ISO New England. And further research found that it was really due to a couple of things. You know, the three-year look ahead, of course, is always going to be inaccurate at some level. But more importantly, there was capacity coming into the New England system that the ISO didn't even know existed. They weren't aware it was coming online. So as they were doing their calculations to figure out how much capacity they needed, they were overshooting by such a large amount because they weren't aware of all this other stuff happening behind the scenes. And so what ended up happening is, you know, the ISO started to realize what was going on, and they completely changed their load forecasting to accommodate that, you know, that behind the scene, behind the meter solar panels that are coming onto the system. And at the same time, we also had corporate buyers. These are the folks who are going to places like REBA and Level 10, guys like Facebook and Microsoft, and you know, a bunch of other companies who want to, you know, be 100% sustainable. And so we have all these forces. You have the behind the meter solar coming on, you have the green buyers coming in and buying capacity in large quantities. And then we have the state also coming in with their own energy goals, and they're buying capacity as well. So all of these hidden capacity procurements that were going on behind the scenes, which ISO didn't know about, created a real problem because of the amount of excess capacity that was coming onto the system. This actually creates a couple of problems, to be candid. One, energy consumers in New England are charged for that capacity. So even if it's never used, the ISO still has to pay those generators to be available. And at one point, you know, over a two-year period, it was almost $1 billion in excess amounts paid to, you know, to these generators who actually never even came online.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. Let's pivot for a moment about some recent activities that you've been dealing with regarding the Massachusetts Attorney General's office. So, and prior to preparing for this podcast, you've been neck deep in meetings with them. You've even described that tensions are running high in New England over the capacity and market problems, which were exacerbated by FERC's recent order to institute the minimum offer price rule on state subsidized resources in the PJM capacity market. For our listeners, can you break down what exactly is going on here?
Yeah. So, I guess it was about 3 months ago, the Massachusetts Attorney General's office launched essentially a petition campaign calling for Massachusetts residents to sign the petition requesting that ISO New England make changes to their market rules that would support the procurement of capacity, green capacity, renewable capacity, to meet Massachusetts' demand. And we've seen this a lot. You know, places are, different states are setting goals, like Rhode Island just set a goal of 100% renewable by 2040, I believe, and Maine is doing something very similar as well. So we're seeing states around the nation who want to take a lead in addressing some of their climate concerns, and they're doing so by purchasing green energy through, in many cases, RFPs. So that sort of sets the stage for this tension to exist, where these procurements outside of the wholesale market are taking place. And ISO New England, who's federally regulated, really doesn't have the ability, at least through its tariff, to satisfy those state targets, those state environmental targets, because they were never given that opportunity by the federal regulators, and they report to FERC. So here we see this tension building up between the federal regulators, who ISO is controlled by, and we have the state regulators who have their desires for you know, to address climate change and procurement of renewable energy resources. And they're it's like an impedance mismatch. They're unable to come together, largely because of this what I'll call, you know, regulatory chasm that really needs to be addressed. The situation in PJM with the FERC MOPA order from December 19th is just another another example of the differences between the states and the federal government. Basically, what FERC said is that the state resources, which are being procured through RFPs, are receiving financial aid, basically a subsidy. And if those resources were to enter the capacity markets in New England, they could come in at a very low price because they're already receiving support, financial support outside of the markets. So they can come in and offer a very low price, and that ends up, you know, really pushing the price, the value capacity down to a point where the generators who have to buy fuel and have personnel on site to keep the turbines spinning, they just simply aren't earning enough money in order to support their operations. So what FERC has said is, if there's a renewable, and I'm kind of paraphrasing here, but any renewable energy project, new energy project, that receives a subsidy from a federal or a state subsidy, and they come in different forms, RECs and other forms, but RFPs are the most prevalent right now, that they would be required to submit, if they're going to enter the capacity market, they're required to enter a price, a minimum offer price that is fairly high. In fact, so high that some people believe that the renewable energy resources will never receive a capacity payment because they effectively have to charge such a high price that they aren't able to compete as the capacity market value drops. And that's the way capacity market works. It starts at a high number, like $15, and it keeps dropping. It's called a descending clock auction. And the auction continues until resources back out based on price. So you might have 40,000 megawatts of resources that, you know, lined up for the capacity market, but they're lining up for maybe 30,000 of actual capacity procurement. So you see, it's a very competitive situation. You got 10,000 more megawatts available than what you need. As the price drops, eventually the offers basically get withdrawn from the table. And the auction continues until the offers that are still on the table match or exceed the required amount, say 30,000 megawatts. And in many cases, the auction actually hits the floor, which is you still at the very last step, you have more capacity available than what you need. So, you know, let's say you need 30,000. Well, if you get to the end of the auction and it's 30 and you have 32,000 available, then you basically have to reduce the amount that you pay all of those generators because of the excess. It's sort of you think of it as a proration. But that's how the situation is today. And FERC's and the FERC MOPR basically is sort of a shot over the bow that says, states, you're just not going to be able to participate in wholesale markets if you're going to continue to subsidize, renewable energy. But here again, you know, states have their own goals in mind, which is, you know, they want to address climate change and they want to get to 100% renewable energy. And so they're sort of left in a situation where the two are looking across a chasm at each other and there is no bridge. And so this is the tension we have today. It's difficult to see where this will all go.
Dick, if I can chime in here and kind of bring it back to your meeting and your work with the Massachusetts Attorney General's office, I was wondering if you could comment on what it was about Massachusetts specifically that you thought made it the right place to start in New England with these efforts? Was it that they were the most likely to respond well? Was it, were they the ones that, you know, most indicated a willingness to listen? You know, what went into that?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, Matt. I think, you know, Massachusetts took the lead in trying to resolve this tension between the states and the federal regulators in getting, you know, some movement, if you will, to have the wholesale markets change so that there would be some alignment or harmonization, if you will, between what the states want to achieve and what the federal government wants to achieve. We've seen a couple of things. We've had several senators from New England send letters to FERC. We've had attorney generals send letters to FERC from New England. And the last thing that happened that really, I think, set the stage was this online petition drive calling for ISO New England to change. That was basically, you know, them saying, enough's enough. We want to see some action here. And so that petition drive really did set the stage for an opportunity to go in and talk with the Attorney General's office about a project that I've been working on, which I submitted to the North American Energy Standards Board, called the Always On Capacity Exchange. When I approached the AGO's energy division, they were very interested to learn more about how this worked. And so I spent about an hour and 40 minutes with them going over the ACE design, which basically attempts to do two things. So just like when I was working at ISO New England and we got the call to solve the first FCM clearing engine problem, I addressed this challenge the same way, just as if I was at ISO New England. And I said, okay, well, if I have to have an objective function that includes two objectives, which is help the states meet their energy targets and ensure that the ISO has enough of the right resources available for reliability, then that would define essentially the problem space, if you will, to address. And so as I started to look at that space, I realized that the green buyers had already created a very nice solution in the form of their capacity exchanges. This is a case where a company like Facebook and Google and all the others come into the capacity exchange like REBA's, and they indicate their desire to purchase some amount of power. And then from that, there are generators who step forward and offer to satisfy that requirement in the form of a PPA. And so what that does is it establishes a long-term capacity commitment between the generator and the buyer themselves. And so, you know, that in essence sets us up for what could also work as a wholesale market operation. So what I did was I borrowed what REBA and Level 10 are doing, and I said, let's bring that into a wholesale market operation, assuming like ISO New England would be running it. And then that way you can address a couple of the issues I mentioned earlier. One thing, the ISO would have visibility to those procurements that are happening outside of the market today. And that capacity exchange would also enable states to come in and get acquire their, you know, whatever they need to meet their energy targets through the exchange, which the ISO would have visibility to. And that would then enable the ISO to know precisely how much capacity is out in their future and perhaps end up doing a much better job at forecasting what their real needs are when they can see just how much capacity is already lined up within the system. So I went through that design with the Attorney General's office, and I think that was a little bit outside the box. We don't, you know, the utility industry is not known for being innovative, they're really more risk averse. So what I was proposing, which is borrowed entirely from REBA and Level 10, is to take that capacity exchange concept and just turn that into a wholesale market capacity offering.
How have your discussions been so far with your meeting with state decision makers? What's your impression regarding the direction that the state will ultimately take?
Yeah, there's a lot in the stew right now. And if you look at the different objectives, let's just take the state goals, state energy goals is one. So you got all of the Northeast states have some form of a stated energy goal except for New Hampshire. And if you look at what people believe is a solution to hit those energy goals, those renewable energy goals, we hear people talk about carbon pricing. And in fact, New York ISO has issued a proposal for carbon pricing. So that is certainly one approach to try to hit that renewable target. But it's there's no perfect solution. Every one of these solutions has something that you wish you could change. And like in the case of the New York ISO, the way that proposal is laid out, it basically says that anyone who uses electricity will end up paying an additional carbon tax for the fossil fuels that were used to generate that electricity. And they would have to pay that carbon tax on electricity so long as there are fossil generators on the system producing power. Now today, we're very dependent on these fossil fuels generators to keep the lights on. More times than not, it's a fossil fuel generator that is what we call the marginal unit. It's the one that is needed in order to meet the current demand. And those offer prices from those marginal units are what set the wholesale price of electricity. Now imagine if you had, today we don't have a carbon tax. If you added a carbon tax, you might go from instead of paying $30 a megawatt hour, you could be paying $45 a megawatt hour. Whereas if you didn't have that carbon tax, you wouldn't have that situation. What makes the New York proposal a little bit dicey, at least in my mind, is the fact that this carbon tax only applies to electricity, which means that, someone who's driving a gasoline car today, you'd hope they'd be incented to, cut back on their fossil fuel their carbon footprint by replacing it with an EV. Well, the problem is, if you cause the electricity price to skyrocket at the same time that gasoline prices are going down because demand is dropping, it sets the stage for a situation where a consumer has to decide, do I, bite the bullet and buy an EV knowing that the price is going to go up for electricity for years to come? Or do I just say, I'll just keep running my gasoline car because it's cheaper to do that? And so that's why, the carbon pricing proposal over in New York, I think is very different. It's very different from the carbon tax concept that's being discussed in Congress, because the Congress proposal addresses fossil fuels across the board. So you don't have that sort of that arbitrage situation between gasoline and electricity that they'll have in New York if the carbon pricing proposal goes through.
Right, right. So what does this mean for you and companies like you that are service providers to the ISOs?
Yeah, it's a very tenuous time. There's a lot of uncertainty right now. It doesn't matter really where you look. You talk a generator today, and the energy prices they're seeing just aren't enough to sustain them. And it's because the renewables that are out there supplying power are doing so at an offer price of zero. So they're willing to accept whatever the clearing price is, knowing pretty likely that it's going to be set by a fossil fuel. So they're going to generate it, so they're going to make money. So there's some uncertainty amongst generators today. There's uncertainty amongst investors about which, what's going to happen with this tension between the federal and the state regulators. And so companies like mine are sort of stuck in the middle here. We're waiting to see what the direction is going to be. And at this juncture, we're not just, everyone seems to be talking a lot, but there doesn't seem to be a lot of forward progress in trying to resolve the matter. Now, I do have to admit, though, the place we're seeing the most activity is with the green buyers, the Googles, the Microsofts. And here in New England, it's more like the Raytheons and the New Balance and the Akamais. They're also doing this as well. They're local companies. So they are basically, proceeding down their own path in acquiring this capacity without regard to, what's happening between the feds and the states. So in my view, that's ultimately going to be a pressure point that I suspect is going to come into play, and hopefully we'll see some resolution that everyone can find acceptable going forward.
Ted, you mentioned that it's a lot of talk and not a lot of progress, and maybe the green buyers are the one who's going to take action. But do you have any sense of an anticipated timeline where you finally do expect push to come to shove, or is this going to be the can that keeps getting kicked down the road?
Well, that's a great question, Matt. I think if you're looking for, leading indicators, the best one I can think of is essentially that FERC order that was issued to PJM that basically said, you guys have to submit a filing to FERC. I think it's either in March or May, I can't remember, but it's this year, it's before the summer, where PJM is going to have to come forward with their proposed solution to address the order that they're now living under. So I would say, before June, and largely because of the FERC MOPR action and the required filing by PJM, and there's been an awful lot of pushback, by the way, on the FERC order. If you go to the FERC e-library and you do a search, you'll find that there's been quite a bit of filings in opposition to the FERC order, but also a lot of confusion about how to even apply the FERC order. So something is going to happen before June in some form or fashion, I suspect.
It's a sad reality that every state is different as it relates to regulations, transmission, and distribution. Do you get the sense that other ISOs are watching, and do you think they may adopt a similar course of action in the future?
Yeah, there's definitely the other ISOs, and let me be careful here, not all of them, okay, because some ISOs are different. For example, ERCOT is its own entity, and they don't have a capacity market. But if you look at the markets like PJM, New York ISO, and ISO New England, they're really the ones that are right at the front lines of the battle today. And this tension is becoming it's very visible. I'll give you an example. There was a recent announcement that came out of Connecticut where they actually talked about the possibility of leaving the ISO New England wholesale markets. And if that were to happen, that would, that would not be a very positive indicator of any near-term solution for this tension that we're seeing. Illinois did something very similar. They made a similar announcement when they saw the FERC order come out. So other ISOs are clearly facing the same kind of challenges that ISO New England is facing. Not ERCOT, and CalISO is actually doing their own thing. It looks like they're going to establish a central buyer, for capacity, and that would be the approach they would take to try and resolve the matter. But here in the Northeast and the Mid-Atlantic, between the three ISOs that are here, this is where the battle lines are drawn, if you will, in trying to resolve this very important problem that is really at the heart of the energy transition, and I think is largely is a result of the energy transition as well.
Well, it's a fascinating discussion. You're in the center of the storm, Dick, no doubt about it. I think my head is still spinning. Matt, how about you?
You said it, but that's why I'm glad we have experts like Dick in the Energy Central community that we can rely upon to keep us educated and up to date.
Let me just say one thing, guys. You know, I have to tell you, Energy Central is such an important part of the consciousness of this industry. It's like plugging into a real time network of information and discussion on topics that ultimately are going to, in some way, influence the outcome. So, Energy Central is it's the place where I think some of the ideas will be born, and maybe some of the negotiation actually occurs. Online, it'd be really fascinating if Energy Central could ultimately be the sort of the catalyst that helps bring all this stuff to a resolution. It'd be a fun thing to be part of too.
Well, we're working on it. Thank you for that.
You're doing a good job too. Yeah, doing a good job.
Thank you for that. So once again, thank you to our guest Dick Brooks for his thought leadership and his committed work to the energy field. You can always reach Dick through the Energy Central platform where he welcomes your questions and comments. I also want to thank our contributing partners of Energy Central, ESRI, the Environmental System Research Institute. ESRI is an international supplier of geographic information, GIS software, WebGIS, and geodatabase management applications. To Guidehouse, formerly Navigant, a leading global provider of consulting services to the public and commercial markets with expertise in energy, sustainability, and infrastructure. To Oracle Utilities, providing best-in-class utilities management solutions to improve reliability, service, and safety for electric, water, and natural gas companies. To Autonix Digital, a Black & Veatch company. Autonix Digital software helps companies simplify asset performance management by putting data to work. And lastly, Bentley Systems, a software development company that supports the professional needs of those responsible for creating and managing the world's infrastructure projects. Once again, I'm your host, Jason Price. Plug in and stay fully charged in the discussion by hopping into the community at energycentral.com. And see you next time at Energy Central's Power Perspectives Podcast.